Welcome back, Red Ice members. We are talking to Kevin Randall about ufology, a very interesting discussion about some of the overarching ideas, some of the problems, some of the theories. And in this second hour here, we are going to begin then to dive more in detail into the MJ-12 documents, at least here at the beginning. And then we'll see if we can talk a little bit more about some of the crashes throughout history, as it were, which Kevin is detailing in his new book called Crash. But Kevin, maybe you just can paint the picture a little bit for us here when it comes to MJ-12 and specifically the MJ-12 documents, so people basically know what we're talking about here, Kevin.
I would hope anybody listening in would have a idea of what they were. Back in 1984, Bill Moore, with his friend partner Jamie Shandera, released a number of documents that reportedly came from an unknown source, that showed an investigation by the United States government at the very highest level of the UFO crash at Roswell. That this was a document that was a briefing paper designed for President-elect Eisenhower in 1952 to let him know what had been found at Roswell. And all that was available was the first few pages that kind of outlined the situation, gave a list of the members of this committee that Harry Truman had commissioned to study this, including military officers and scientists at the highest levels, so that Eisenhower would know what was going on. And a memo from Harry Truman supposedly giving permission for this to go on. I think about the same time, Good, what's Good's first name from England?
Let's see here.
Top Secret. His first name escapes. Timothy Good.
Timothy Good, okay.
Gotcha. Timothy Good also had gotten a copy of the documents, but they were sanitized a little bit. There was some redacting on them. And he released them almost immediately, which kind of forced Bill Moore into doing the same thing. So in the beginning, here's a set of documents that are classified that talk about an oversight committee to exploit the find of the alien craft at Roswell. A lot of people got very interested and very excited about these sorts of things, me among them, because this was the smoking gun. This says, yeah, the U.S. government has it, and they've been studying it. This is what we've been needed, some kind of documentation. The skeptical community, the debunkers, the deniers, immediately said, no, these things are faked. And they said they were faked for a number of reasons, some of which are now we see as valid, some of which are not. So that's sort of where it came from. Yeah, Roswell was real. Here are the documents. Here are the guys involved. Every man named on the MJ-12 document was dead. So we couldn't go to that guy and say, here, we've got evidence. The guy was dead. And I think the last one had died just literally months before the documents hit the public arena. Over the years, a lot of people have researched this. Stan Friedman actually asked a fellow named Peter Tytel, who's a question document expert in New York City, to look at the documents and come up with a conclusion. Tytel eventually said, no, they're fake, based on his analysis of the typewriter that would have been used, on the signature of Harry Truman on the memo granting permission to do this, and things like that. Tytel said they were fake. Tytel would not issue a formal statement until somebody paid his fee, and nobody wanted to pony up the $2,500 or $3,000 he wanted for his fee, so he wouldn't produce a written document, but if you talk to him on the phone, he'd tell you, now this thing is a fake. So that's kind of where we were. One side saying, yeah, here are the documents, they're real. The other side saying, no, they're fake for a number of reasons. The FBI looked at it from the point of view of that if the documents are authentic, then somebody has released highly classified material in violation of the law and somebody should go to jail. Their conclusion was that there was nothing to it. I think the Air Force investigated under a similar idea that somebody had violated the law by releasing classified information to those not authorized to have it, and concluded there was nothing to that. I looked at the things. I was excited when they first came out. I think actually in the UFO case book, I make a case for it, the documents being authentic. But since that time, I've looked into it in more detail. I've concluded that the documents were fake. And just recently, and this is part of what came out of working on the book Crash, there was a story that I had published in other books about a fellow named Robert Willingham, who was a high-ranking Air Force officer, a colonel, who claimed to have been involved with a UFO crash in 1950. He was a fighter pilot. He'd been flying Chase during an experiment of a bomber, and this thing had crossed their path, and he had managed to get down to see the crashed object, and it disappeared. Well, this story also appears in the MJ-12 document, that the December 6, 1950 Del Wheel crash is part of the MJ-12 papers. Well, as I was doing Crash, I was putting together the thing on the Del Rio case, and I thought, well, gee whiz, maybe I ought to see if there's anything new. And this is where the Internet becomes the wonderful tool that it is. I just typed Del Rio UFO crash in, and I came up to Willingham and discovered that there had been a book written about it by Noah Torres and Ruben somebody, about the other Roswell. And so I took a look at that and discovered that Willingham's story had changed significantly. The date was different, the aircraft he was flying different, the airbase he was at was different. All kinds of things changed on it. This set up red flags. So I wrote to Torres, and he was very, very cordial in his response, sent me all the information I wanted. The story changed significantly. And looking at this, it seemed to suggest another way that the MJ-12 document was a hoax, because Willingham, if he was an Air Force officer and the crash that he's now talking about took place in 1954 as opposed to 1950, then the MJ-12 document either is predictive of this event, meaning it hadn't happened yet and they predicted it, or the thing was a fake. And written sometime after the Del Rio Cook case entered the mainstream. Mm-hmm. I'm convinced now that Willingham was not a high-ranking military officer. I believe he was a lieutenant colonel in what's called the Civil Air Patrol, which is an auxiliary, a civilian auxiliary of the United States Air Force. You don't get paid, you don't get retirement points, you don't get anything for being in the Civil Air Patrol other than the good feeling you get for participating in search and rescues and that sort of thing. But its affiliation is through the Air Force. You wear an Air Force-like uniform with the distinctive insignia saying that it's Civil Air Patrol, it's not the Air Force, and that sort of thing. But Willingham has been photographed wearing a modified Civil Air Patrol uniform, as if it's a regular Air Force uniform, and claiming that he was a high-ranking Air Force officer. Well, if that's not true, then the Del Rio crash isn't true, and if the Del Rio crash isn't true, then the MJ-12 document is fake. There is a way to get to the MJ-12, get from the Del Rio crash to the MJ-12 document through a fellow named Todd Zeckel. That's another long story, but the whole point is, as I was working on Crash, I was looking at the Del Rio case simply as to include it as one of the few seemingly legitimate cases based on my belief that Willingham was an Air Force colonel. But that is now all collapsed. So I do not accept the Del Rio case as being authentic anymore. And if it's not authentic, this is another indication that the MJ-12 document is fraudulent. And some of this is discussed in my book, Crash. Great detail about how I got to where I went is discussed in Crash.
I see. And so there's multiple things, obviously, questions that the results out of this and your conclusions and so forth as well. But if we just begin with the idea, where do you think the documents come from? Who potentially are faking them, and for what reason? Theories about that.
Back in the 1980s, Bill Moore, who did a lot of the initial work on the Roswell case, said to a number of people, and this is easily documented, that he was thinking about faking some kind of a Roswell document. Because he'd run into a brick wall. He couldn't take the investigation any further than he had, which strikes me as very, very odd, because there were an awful lot of witnesses whose names we were able to divine 10 years later that he should have been able to find. But there was talk about him creating some kind of a document. Also, in 1980, Moore hooked up with a fellow named Bob Pratt, who had been a reporter for National Enquirer, who had done some wonderful work on UFOs. If you, in the late 70s, early 80s, if you were reading National Enquirer for the UFO stories, you were getting very accurate information because Bob Pratt was investigating stories, and he wasn't making the stuff up. He was just publishing what he could find, honestly publishing what he could find. And they had been writing a science fiction novel in which the Majestic 12 surfaces for the first time. Well, later on, Bill Moore says that his friend Jamie Shandera had received these documents on an undeveloped roll of film from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Well, there's an amazing coincidence right there. But also, which also ties this in, Todd Zeckel had been talking to Bill Moore about the Del Rio crash and what he'd learned about it. And according to what Zeckel had been saying, he gave Moore all the information about the Del Rio crash. And what I suspect happened is that Moore believed that Willingham was a high-ranking Air Force officer. And so to cover this, they inserted into the MJ-12 document the stuff about the Del Rio crash. But in that, they say that the craft had been basically incinerated, so there'd be little evidence to be recovered as a way of acknowledging the crash and making the document seem more authentic, but precluding Zeckel from going forward with his plans to publish a book about it. So I think it's all tied in there, and when you look at the dynamics of what's going on, I think that's where the MJ-12 document originated. It was designed specifically to propel those who had the documents, meaning Moore, Shandera, and later Stan Friedman, and I think Stan Friedman had absolutely no hand in this at all, propel them into the spotlight, which it did, and kept that going for another 6 or 7 years. But now as we look at the information contained in the document, one of the things that strikes me and has struck others is the information contained in the document is the state of ufology or the Roswell investigation as it existed in 1980 as opposed to where it is in 2009. We have moved beyond the information in there. We've learned a great deal about the Roswell case, and the information about Roswell is inaccurate. The information about the Del Rio case is inaccurate. There's no mention of a crash on the plains of San Agustin, which is a good thing for me because I don't believe there was a crash there. And it's a bad thing for Stan because if this is a briefing paper for the president about the state of ufology in 1952, why isn't that mentioned in there? Yeah. So it's a paper that was designed in the 1980s to reflect the state of the investigation in the 1980s, and yet today we know so much more, we can point out all the flaws into it. So it's a paper filled with anachronisms.
Does this mean to you that a group like MJ-12 never existed, or is it, just they're trying to replicate something that actually potentially was happening in reality at that time, that there was a group formed and there was investigations looking into the UFO phenomena, but it was like MJ-12 in itself is a code name for another group. What's your take on that, Kevin?
We have run into one witness, General Arthur Exon, who had been the base commander at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in the 1970s, and he had been assigned to the base in 1947 as a lieutenant colonel. General Exon told me, I think he told Don Schmidt, I think he told several others, that there had been some kind of an oversight committee at the Pentagon that ran the UFO operations. He called them the Unholy 13 because he didn't know what the name of the group was. So the Unholy 13, and I think some of the skeptics have seized on this, is that was the name of the group, but no, it really isn't. It was just the name he applied to it for his own ease of referring to them. That was responsible for the UFO phenomenon and would be responsible for exploiting the find at Roswell. One of the things he told me that I found a little bit surprising when he said it was Stuart Symington, who had been a senator from Missouri to the United States Congress, was involved in this. And I couldn't understand why you would have an elected official at that level involved in this MJ-12 committee until I discovered that Stuart Symington had been the undersecretary for air in the old War Department and then later moved into the Department of Defense. In 1947, he had been an appointee in this high civilian position over the United States Air Force. So then it made sense. MJ-12 mentions nothing about Stuart Symington. Well, it makes sense that he should be there. The second thing that struck me was if this crash took place in 1947, why is Eisenhower not involved in it in 1947? He was the chief of staff of the Army, which was broken into the ground forces, the air forces at the time in 1947. He's the number one guy in the military. He's the number one Army guy. So if the crash takes place and the Army recovered it in Roswell, which they did, it would have gone up the chain of command from the 509th headquarters in Roswell to the 8th Air Force headquarters in Fort Worth, the Strategic Air Command headquarters, which at that time were in Washington, D.C., to the Chief of Staff's office. He would have already known about it. The briefing paper becomes unimportant at that point. So he should have been on the committee, but he wasn't. So the point simply is this. There would have been some sort of commission, committee, group responsible for this, the investigation of this. It would have been made up of top scientists, top military officers. Some of the names on the MJ-12 document, Devlin Bronk, for example, Von Neumann, as another example of scientists at the top, should have been involved. But the military officers that you would expect to be involved, such as Eisenhower, were not. That was delegated to other people, and I find that a little bit suspicious. So there would have been some kind of committee. The MJ-12 document suggests there's a committee, but it doesn't really name all the right people.
So, again, it doesn't discredit the fact that the government has been involved potentially in crash retrieval or trying to understand the phenomenon and all this. It's just the validity of the documents themselves seems to be fraudulent. Is that correct?
That's right. And now we're to the point where there's literally thousands of MJ-12 documents. Stan Friedman himself has rejected the vast majority of them. It all comes back to the original few documents, the Eisenhower briefing document, the Truman memo. There's a Cutler-Twining memo that was found in the National Archives, and they hold this up and say, see, we have a providence for that, but the National Archives tells us, well, all we will say is this document, the Cutler-Twining memo, is a document in our possession, but it wasn't found where it should have been. It wasn't created the way it should have been. We don't know whether it's authentic or not, but it's a document that is held in our collections. So we have no real providence for the documents, and this is the huge stumbling block. We don't know where they came from. All research into MJ-12 has never produced a single document relating to MJ-12 with a known provenance from a government source. Never has that happened. And you would think, given the size of the search for MJ-12 materials, you'd have found something like that, but it's never happened. Stan tells me, he says, well, that the lack of providence may be suggestive of it being authentic. And if you talk to any question document examiner, they'll tell you a lack of providence is, in fact, evidence of it being forgery.
There's just a strange little side note here in terms of the Cutler-Twining memo that you mentioned. Apparently, Shander and Moore received postcards with a return address to Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, and the cards contained a series of cryptic messages referring to Rhesus pieces and Soot land and things like this. What do you make of that, Kevin? Have you researched that at all?
This seems to me to be something born of a mind that is more in tune with Hollywood than it is the way things work in the real world. I spent time as an intelligence officer in the Air Force, and admittedly, I was at a very low level in the intelligence field. I think my job was more akin to being a reporter than anything else, where I'd gather information and provide it to our flight crews. In a non-hostile environment, you'll be flying into this airfield. This is what it looks like. Here's the trees at the end of the runway you need to watch out for. The government seems to be a little bit unstable in this South American country. Be careful if you go off base, you know, those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
But what I've seen in the courses I took doesn't really lead us into something in that kind of a clandestine nature. The document that was found in the National Archives based on supposedly the series of postcards was not in the box, is not where it should have been. It was in a box where it shouldn't have been. This box was reviewed by, I think, military officers, but people with security clearances who had the authority to remove anything that was not releasable into the general population. They somehow missed this document. It was not in a folder. It was not where it should have been. And if you talk to the people at the National Archives, which I have done, I've had communication with those people a number of times and been there to look at all these sorts of things. Their opinion is that it was a document planted there. And Stan's belief is it was planted there by someone on MJ-12 who wanted the information released, and in that sense it's authentic. My belief, it was planted there by someone who wanted to keep the myth of MJ-12 going,
mm-hmm.
and in that sense is not authentic. And I know, once again, this does not make me a popular person in the field of ufology because I do not embrace MJ-12.
Hmm. And you mentioned someone from Hollywood, and that is kind of the tidbit that I was reaching for here because, again, the Cutler-Twining memo is from, it was found or whatever, however you want to term that, then in around in 1985, or that's when they began receiving these postcards and so forth. And one of the messages in there were Reese's Pieces. Well, it turns out that in the film E.T., this by Spielberg, there is a product placement for the product Reese's Pieces, and that's released in 1982. So just, you know, what does that have to do with anything? Is it internal little hint that it's a fake message, if you know what I mean? It's a product placement, so to speak.
The people who created MJ-12, the fakers who invented the myth, also placed on the document Donald Menzel, who was the great UFO debunker from Harvard University, the UFO denier, if you will. And Stan did a lot of research into Menzel's background and found out during World War II he had a very high security clearance and was involved in cryptoanalysis for the United States government. Well, gee whiz, during World War II, wasn't practically everybody in the United States involved in the war effort in some fashion? I mean, wasn't everybody in the entire world basically involved in the war in some way?
Yeah.
Whether it was on one side or the other. So, I mean, the fact that Menzel, whose background was mathematics and that's in physics, was involved in this thing is not surprising whatsoever. It doesn't lead you to MJ-12. And that may be sort of an inside joke. Menzel, the great UFO denier, was really, really one of the insiders who knew the absolute truth. But Stan has been through Menzel's papers and found absolutely no hint of MJ-12. What we'd like to see is somebody find some document with a providence that mentions MJ-12 that clearly is clearly not bogus, and it has not been done in more than 25, 30 years of search for this sort of thing. I would love nothing better for the documents to have been authentic, because then we can stop arguing about the reality of UFOs and move on to the question of who are they, where do they come from, what do they want. We'll start arguing about whether or not the UFOs are interstellar craft or not, and we haven't been able to get to the more important questions that we should be looking at.
So do you think that this was potentially the purpose then for the hoaxing as well, to kind of just put more, if you will, then disinformation, that it is enough credible, so to speak, to get people's attention going or interest going, but at the same time, it's not enough, it's not good enough, so to speak, to verify its existence. And maybe that's the point, too, to keep people fighting over these kinds of documents and not really moving forward, so to speak.
Well, the thing with the documents, you can look at them as disinformation. And if you're doing disinformation, which is something you put together to lead people astray, and you have to include enough good information in there that they'll believe the entirety of the information. so that when a little bit of it is discredited, you discredit everything. The purpose of disinformation is to do that. I don't think that was the purpose behind it, although there are many people in the UFO community who believe that. I believe that the MJ-12 documents were designed specifically to propel specific people back into the spotlight and hold their place there. Bill Moore himself, in something he and Jamie Chandra had produced in the 1990s, suggested that the documents were fake.
Hmm. Hmm. Well, okay, so what is the extension of this and the program here that we're talking about? There's a number of things that have seemed to spawn out of these various groups. We have things called Project Blue Book, then, for instance. We have Project Sign, Project Grudge. There are a number of these around. Are they all connected in some way, Kevin, or is one standing alone from the other, and is one more valid than the other in terms of your research?
When you look at the UFO history, you find out that in 1947, when the UFO sightings began in the United States and the military was called on to look into this stuff, General Twining, who was at Wright Field at the time, the commander of the Air Materiel Command, suggested in September of 1947 that a classified project be started to investigate UFO sightings, which was Project Sign. So that's a legitimate military investigation. At the same time, they said the code name was Project Saucer. Well, that was the civilian name, and if you were on the outside, you talked about Project Saucer. If you were on the inside, you knew it was Project Sign. This was a legitimate military investigation of UFOs. In 1949, the name Sign was compromised. It got out into the public arena. Project Sign was a real investigation. The name was changed to Project Grudge. So Project Grudge was an investigation, although it wasn't a very good investigation. They now were of the attitude that it was nothing to this. They were going through the motions. Nobody really cared. One of the generals at the Pentagon in 1951, I believe it was, wanted to know whatever happened to that UFO investigation, the flying saucer investigation, was told what was happening. He said, well, that's not right. He revitalized it, appointed Ed Ruppelt to be the chief of the project. They changed the code name to Project Blue Book. Ruppelt started another legitimate investigation of UFOs. After he left his position, it went through a number of different commanders, ending up with Hector Quintanilla, who was the last chief of Project Blue Book, and he closed it out in 1969. Mm. But by the time we get into the 60s, it's more of a public relations outfit rather than an investigative outfit. So in that respect, I guess in that respect, it wasn't really legitimate. It was just answering the public's queries about UFOs, and the Air Force wanted to get rid of Project Blue Book, but they couldn't find a politically expedient way of doing it, which gave rise to the Condon Committee at the University of Colorado, which was the so-called scientific investigation of UFOs. And their job was to determine there was no national security interests in investigation UFOs, and they can close Project Blue Book without endangering national security, which is exactly what they did. Condon, in fact, 18 months before the end of the project, was in Corning, New York, saying to a group of scientists, well, I'd be inclined to tell them right now there's nothing to this thing, but I'm not supposed to discover that answer for another 18 months. There's a hell of a fine scientific investigation. We already know what the answer is, and we're now just looking for the evidence to take us there. And in fact, in 1968, there was the, and I believe, legitimate event in Shag Harbor, Nova Scotia in Canada, of something seen falling into the water, which involved an investigation by the Canadian military, the Mounties, and I think the U.S. had some investigators in there as well. Mm. The Condon Committee called up to Canada, asked a couple of questions, were told that, well, there were some teenagers thought they saw something, and the Condon Committee let it go. Their job was to investigate UFOs. Here's something that's fallen into the lake. There's all kinds of witnesses to it, and they don't even bother to send an investigator to look at it. So how good could their investigation be? Hmm. So that really wasn't legitimate investigation. That was merely a public relations stunt that cost $500,000 to get the Air Force out of the investigation of UFOs business. But what we find out later is there was something called Project Moondust. Mm-hmm. Moondust was designed to recover returning or space debris returning to Earth from unknown origins, which of course could be extraterrestrial. So when that name leaked into the public arena, and the Air Force was queried about it, they said, "Now there's no Project Moondust. It never existed. We've never done that." The State Department inadvertently, the U.S. State Department inadvertently released a number of documents that clearly said Project Moondust on it. Clearly, we have a providence. Clearly, it came from the State Department. We know this, unlike MJ-12. It's been verified by a number of researchers. I even got a set of microfiche with Project Moondust stuff on it. This stuff was given to a United States senator by Cliff Stone, and the senator went back to the Air Force and said, "You know, here's the evidence that Moondust was investigating UFOs." The Air Force response was, "Well, yeah, we did have a Moondust, but we never used it." Hmm. Well, the documents from the State Department proved that Moondust had been used. Robert Todd, another researcher living in Pennsylvania, queried the Air Force about this and asked for the new name, and was told, "We can't give it to you. It's properly classified." So as of 1986, we knew that, A, there had been a project that had gone beyond Blue Book called Moondust, that that was interested in UFOs because there was UFO stuff in their files. In 1986, the code name was changed from Moondust, and we were told the code name could not be released. So there was clearly an investigation that went that far. If we go to the 1990s, we got the Air Force investigating Roswell. Well, I thought the Air Force didn't investigate UFOs. Well, now they're investigating UFOs again, saying, "Well, there's nothing to it. It was just a Project Vogel balloon. You guys are mistaken," and went on from there. So there's these sorts of projects. We know they existed. We've got the documentation to prove they existed. It's really no secret. Those things were authentic.
How about Project Blue Fly? Is that a continuation after Moondust?
That was Operation Blue Fly was actually the mission to move the Moondust people around. So Operation Blue Fly was sort of the logistical support for Project Moondust. So Blue Fly existed in that arena. So if you needed to go somewhere for an investigation, it was Operation Blue Fly that took you there to conduct your Moondust investigations.
So do you know what's going on today? Are there new names and new operations, new projects at work? Or as you said, alluded to before, has this all been moved into the kind of public relations type offices of how you deal with the public, so to speak, more than actually retrieving UFOs?
One thing I should make clear is that while Blue Book was a public relation, became a public relations mission, there was other things going on to suggest that the UFO investigations were taken seriously under different auspices. General Exon talked about how he would get a phone call from the Pentagon telling him that there would be X number of people coming in from various locations to Wright Field. A plane would be dispatched from Wright Field to a hot UFO investigation. This was done so that if any reporters got smart and traced the aircraft back, they could get it to Wright Field. They said, "Well, that was Project Blue Book." But there was another investigation going on under different auspices to investigate these things. General Bolander said in 1960 that UFO cases, some of the UFO cases, the really inexplicable UFO cases, were not part of the Blue Book system. And Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who was a consultant of the Blue Book, said that the good stuff never got to Blue Book. So while Blue Book was in operation, there was a concurrent investigation going on under a different name with different personnel to investigate the really interesting UFO stuff.
How about that? That's very interesting. And again, just to reiterate, that all of this then seemed to have been spawned out of the Roswell crash, and so much is circled around this particular event. But you mentioned something before, and you go into detail, I guess, about this in your new book, Crash, as well, then, that this phenomena does not only, it's a modern phenomena. We look at it back to 1947 here, but you mentioned a case back all the way back to 840 AD in France before?
Looking at what I want to do in the book, Crash, because these lists of UFO crashes are close to 300, and I just find it incredible that you've developed a technology that allows you to travel interstellar distances. and about the time you arrive, you crash. It just doesn't make sense.
That's right.
And if you look at our evolution of technology, you'll see how the mean time to failure has increased, so that the devices we build today are much more reliable than the devices we built 50 years ago. And so I wanted to look at that, and there's a number of stories in UFO books about this event that took place in 840 AD in France that sounds suspiciously like some of the contact details from the 1950s. And that when you look at the different ways it was portrayed, it's not nearly as mysterious as you would think. And so I wanted to explore that. There was another event that took place in the 16th century that sounds suspiciously like ball lightning, and yet it's recounted in some of the UFO books as if it was another crash. So I looked at those sorts of things and said, you know, this is where we are. But when we get to 1947, and in the book it actually talks an awful lot about the ghost rocket cases, some of them not very, very exciting, some of them very exciting, mm-hmm. from the 1946, a lot of that in Scandinavia, some of it in Europe. And then, of course, the emphasis switches to the United States. And because I happen to be located in the United States, I have an opportunity to investigate these a lot more thoroughly than I can some of the other events in other locations around the world. But we're looking at all of those sorts of things up through the event that took place in 2009. And what was interesting, this took place in July of 2009 in Ottawa. And Chris Rakowski and I were at the MUFON convention in Denver, Colorado in August. And I got home and found this, and I'm finishing up the book to get it turned in, and I found this crash from Canada. So I wrote to Chris about it, and he sent me all the information I could possibly want about it. Mm-hmm. And so he wasn't very excited about it at all, and so we took that tack. But so we moved from 840 AD to basically July of 2009, looking at a lot of events. Some events I just didn't bother with because they clearly were meteorites. Some of those are clearly meteorites. I'll look at. There's a crash case in the Project Blue Book files I've never heard of. And I blundered across that looking for something else. So that's recounted in there, this event that took place in Oregon, I believe, where they found some debris. I think the debris they found is all terrestrially based, but here was something that was recounted in the Project Blue Book file. So I said, well, you know, here's my source of material, Project Blue Book, on this crash. What's interesting in the Project Blue Book files, I've only been able to find a single mention of the Roswell crash. And there are other cases that were clearly hoaxes that are recounted in the Blue Book files. But in the Roswell case, I could only find one mention. It's a middle paragraph of a three-paragraph article in another case file. And all it does is mention that Walter Hott had received a blistering rebuke for his reporting of the UFO crash at Roswell. So all I can find in the Project Blue Book files about this. Mm. Other cases that are clearly hoaxes are in the Project Blue Book files, but this case, which the Air Force said was a mobile balloon, somehow, even though it was front page news around the country, around the world, Walter Hott talked about getting phone calls from Europe and Asia and Australia. That somehow wasn't mentioned in the Project Blue Book files, which I find fascinating. But the book looks at all of that stuff. There's a good section on Blue Book. There's a section on the Las Vegas UFO crash. A lot of stuff about Kecksburg, thanks to Chris. The fellow who Stan Gordon, who has investigated that for years. Mm-hmm. Stuff on the Sag Harbor stuff that I got from Don Ledger and Chris Stiles, which they're very, very helpful on. So it's just a compendium of a look at all that. It's my take on this and why I accept these cases as being legitimate, why these cases I think are probably hoaxes.
Mm. Very interesting what you mentioned before there as well, in terms of the fact that whatever it was in terms of Roswell that came here, traveled all this way then and then to crash. The question that arises here is some of the theories is that it was shot down and so forth. Is there any evidence that seems to suggest this, Kevin?
No, I don't have anything that's shot down. And then we're talking about how radar had knocked it out of the sky, and I'm thinking, gee whiz, you can travel interstellar distances, but a radar beam knocks it out of the sky? I don't think so.
Mm.
But the theory that I've always kind of liked, and it's a very science fiction-oriented theory, is that the aliens discover civilization on the verge of space travel. They want to introduce themselves to the inhabitants of the planet in the most non-threatening way possible. So they crash a disk, put the bodies of some of their fellow spacefarers who may have died on the trip into it, so there's an introduction, and they're thwarted by the U.S. government, who finds the thing, cleans it all up, says, no, it never happened. So their attempt to introduce themselves in a non-threatening way has been trumped by the U.S. government in that respect. Is that a viable theory? Not really, but it's an interesting one, and one that's kind of fun to speculate about. But my point really is this. If you can travel interstellar distances, you probably aren't going to crash with great regularity. But by the same token, no matter how good your technology is, it's going to fail. And if it doesn't fail, there's always, in the human world, there's always somebody to screw it up, to make a mistake, push the wrong button, hook something up backwards to cause these catastrophic failures. So there's always that possibility that even though your technology may approach perfection, the biological entities who are driving the thing are capable of making a mistake to bring it down.
Mm.
So I have no problem with accepting one or two possible UFO crashes, but not 300. I mean, they're like raining out of the sky, for God's sake. If you go to New Mexico and you study New Mexico, you know, they just seem like they were falling out of the sky every other week.
Mm. So how about, in terms of Roswell, how about bodies and so forth, that someone found three bodies and then took them away, one allegedly a little bit of alive even? Takes on that?
There were bodies found. We've talked to a number of witnesses who saw them. The skeptics, the debunkers, the deniers, always say, well, how many bodies were there? You know, some people say three, some people say five, some people say four. How many bodies were there? Well, the answer is the person who's giving us the number saw that many bodies. You know, it doesn't mean just because one person said he saw three and another person said he saw four doesn't mean they're both wrong. It means that one person saw three and one person saw more.
Mm.
And that's not a big problem. Colonel Blanchard, who was the base commander, commander of the 509 Bomb Group, told a friend of his, Chester Liddell, who was a well-respected scientist and held a number of patents, and they were good friends and worked on a number of projects together. In fact, when Liddell's wife was having a baby, Blanchard, as the commander, arranged to get Liddell from Alaska to Chicago, where the child was going to be born, so he could be there for it. So they were very good friends. And Liddell said that Blanchard told him that there had been bodies. The thing was real and there had been bodies. So, I mean, Liddell was a very respected scientist who would have no point in making something like that up. He says it came from Blanchard. Edwin Easley said the very cryptic thing about, oh, the creatures, when asked about it, but before he died, told family a little bit more about that, told his family a little bit more about that. The skeptics and the debunkers, in fact, have tried to denigrate the Easley testimony, and what they've done is confused Easley with Curry Holden and one other fellow,
mm-hmm,
who talked about their involvement and lumped all of this to Easley and said, well, see, we can disprove this, this, and this. Doesn't detract from Easley, and in fact, really doesn't detract from the other two guys. But what it does do is make the debunkers and the deniers look bad. But Easley talked about that sort of thing. So there've been people who talked about bodies, and just recently they were knocking Frankie Rowe, whose father had been a lieutenant with the fire department in Roswell, who said that her father told her about seeing the bodies and seeing one alive. And they said, well, Frankie Rowe didn't know that. Her father wasn't there, blah, blah, blah. Why doesn't any of the other fire department know about that? And we actually found one of the firefighters from Roswell. He's 90 years old, went back and interviewed him again and discovered why there was no record of the run from the Roswell Fire Department out to the crash site. It's because an Air Force officer came to the fire department and said, you don't need to go out there. We got it covered. And Frankie Rowe's father went out there in his private car to look around. And that's why none of the other firefighters knew a thing about it, and that's why there was no run. A perfect explanation. We just discovered that 6 or 8 months ago, so we can answer that question. So there were a number of people who talked about bodies. Some of them talked about seeing them firsthand. Some of them talked about family members who have seen them and told them about it. There is some discussion that one may have survived for a period of time. That I'm not as confident with. That information I'm not as confident about as I am with some of the other information. But there were bodies recovered.
Very interesting. And you brought up Kecksburg very briefly as well there, and that's another one of these very interesting stories and testimonials on how the military moved in. And again, in that particular case, there is a story about an entity or a being basically inside this acorn-shaped capsule that landed. What's your take on that, Kevin?
Kecksburg is really a tough one for me. I go back and forth on that one because one day I'm thinking, yeah, okay, this is extraterrestrial. The next day I'm thinking, well, maybe not. Maybe another explanation. I know Robert Young, who's sort of the anti-Stan Gordon, has proposed a number of explanations for the Kecksburg thing that is very good. One of the major witnesses for the Kecksburg thing that talks about the acorn-shaped craft is a very shady character, and I'm not sure I'd believe him if he told me the sun was in the sky or not. But Stan Gordon has done a wonderful job and has gathered a great deal of information that suggests it was not something natural and it was not an Earth-based technology that was recovered at Kecksburg. So I go back and forth on that one. I'm just not sure. That would be what I would put in the unknown category, the unidentified category. I'm just really not sure on Kecksburg where to set that down. But the big four that I look at would be Roswell, Las Vegas in 1962, Kecksburg in 65, and Shag Harbor in 68 are the really big UFO crashes that are very interesting, and there's a lot of information about. There's a lot of other ones that are single witness that are interesting, but they're single witness. And there's others that clearly are not alien. They might be extraterrestrial because they're the result of meteors or bolides. But there's four that are really prominent, in to my mind at least, that have a good shot of being something alien.
And you know, as we begin to round things up here, there's multiple obviously different sightings and different bigger events, so to speak, that would happen around the world and even recently. But one of these that is known is the Phoenix Lights, for instance. What's your take on that, then, Kevin?
Well, with the Phoenix Lights, I think we're getting involved in one of those deals where there's a lot of answers, some of them very satisfactory and some of them not so much. Some of the footage taken over Phoenix in 1997 clearly was flares. There's no doubt in my mind it was flares. And the unit that dropped the flares has been identified. But there's other parts of the Phoenix Lights phenomenon that aren't identified. So I think there's a core of very good sightings there, and I've worked with a couple of people on that. Jim Kelly, I believe, in Phoenix has been very helpful to me on that, providing me the information and that sort of thing with his Arizona MUFON group. So we have a core of very good sightings, but some of the sightings that have gotten the most publicity, I think, have explanations in the mundane. And what, unfortunately, skeptics and the deniers and the believers tend to do is lump everything together. So if you solve one part of it, then the whole thing is solved. And that's not really true. And if one part is unidentified, then the whole thing's unidentified. And that's really not true. You've got to kind of take a look at the various pieces and say, this part we have a solution for. We don't need to worry about that. Let's look at the core that has the solid information that we might be able to learn something new about. Let's look at that stuff and not worry about the ancillary issues.
Okay, very interesting, Kevin Randall. Again, the book is called Crash. It will be out later next year in 2010. This goes into detail in some of the most reported UFO crashes around the world and also in history, then looks at these 300 scenarios or events that has taken place. I want to thank you so much for coming on the program, Kevin, and sharing some of your perspective and research with us. But please, for us again, mention your blog so people know where to go if they want to continue on following more of your work and research, Kevin.
The blog is called A Different Perspective. It's at www.kevinrandall.blogspot.com. Sometimes it pops up if you're looking for a specific sighting. You type in like Socorro UFO, and because I've done some stuff recently about that, my blog pops up there too. So it's kind of all over the UFO field. It's linked from another of different blogs, and I've linked to other blogs that I find interesting. So it's just a look at the UFO phenomena and the unusual from my perspective.
Okay, very good. Keep up the work, the great work, Kevin. And thank you for coming on again the program. And, of course, have a very good Christmas.
Same to you and everybody in Sweden and throughout the world.
That's our program with Kevin Randall. Thank you for joining us. My name is Henrik. Have a good Christmas, and we will be back soon with more radio for you to enjoy during the holidays. My thanks to Fredrik, Elizabeth, and Lana. Take it easy, and we will talk more soon. Bye-bye.